Welcome to Chit Chat Money. Today we have an interview with Chris, our friend from Growth to Value. You may know him as his pseudonym. And we have we've talked about his marketplace on here before, Potential Multibaggers. So multi-time guests. And we're talking about Upstart, which is kind of a popular company. A lot of people tend to follow it. And we've talked about it once before as a not so deep dive.
So you can pair it with both episodes, Maybe if you wanted to listen to that for maybe more of the basics of, say, kind of the income statement, some of the basic valuation numbers, at least at the time, more of the basics in that episode. And this one's more of the deeper dive of kind of the competitive landscape, all that type of stuff. We kind of go for the hard hitting questions with Chris.
Before we get to that, though, we want to talk about our friends, our sponsor, Quarter.
Where you can listen to Upstart's conference calls on.
Actually, yes, you can. And that's where I list all my conference calls. It's the most intuitive solution. It's, I think, maybe the only mobile solution.
And they have an iPad app that I like to use to read on.
Yes, because they have the transcripts. Yeah. So they've got all conference calls for basically any company you might want. They've got so the conference calls, transcripts, and investor presentations. Am I blanking on anything else?
No, but they're adding other stuff. They try to make it the comprehensive connect, you know, like any sort of thing that a company puts out, connect that with investors very easily in all one central place. Cause, you know, it can be difficult on the investor relations page. Some of them are very good, but some of them can be quite poor. So Quarter is trying to improve that for you.
Yeah. And they're growing really fast. It's been fun to watch them kind of gain traction among the investment community, but you can download it on iOS or Android. It's Quarter, Q-U-A-R-T-R, no E, Quarter. And you can also follow them on Twitter at Quarter_app. Before we get to the show real quick, let's just mention that you can still use our code, our holiday code, ChitChat, if you're considering a 7 investing subscription annual. You get $50 off. Go ahead, use it. It's a service that we love.
Limited time offer.
It ends at the new year, so get it in while you can. Without further ado, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Chit Chat Money. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer interview industry experts and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Money is a CCM Media Group podcast. Ryan and Brett are also general partners at Arch Capital, and Arch Capital may have positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Money by Ryan or Brett or any other podcast guests is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
All right. Today we are welcomed by, I want to say, almost fourth or fifth time guest now. You've probably heard us talk about his service, Potential Multibaggers, but it's Chris from Growth to Value. We've had him on the show plenty of times, and today we're talking Upstart. Before we get into what they do and kind of how you came across it, how have you been? It's been, I want to say, 6 months since we last spoke.
Five, I think.
So how have you been?
Great. I'm enjoying the markets, unlike a lot of people, I think. But I see the businesses of the stock that I have picked doing great. The stocks themselves, you know, they fluctuate, of course, but that's temporary. If you zoom out, you see that the businesses are doing great, and the same trends that, you know, were there in February at the top of this growth market, let's call it, are still there, although people often judge on price, of course, often because they do not have enough other information about the businesses that they own or part own. But I think I keep seeing the same things coming back.
All right. Well, and today we're talking Upstart. How did you find Upstart, and when did you first, become attracted to it?
I often look at IPOs. When a new company comes to the market, I'm not pretending that I read the whole S1 or so. Of course not. I don't have the time to read everything, but I look at what kind of company is this and what does it do, etc. And I never buy IPOs, by the way, because of, you know, the incentive. You always have to to ask yourself, you know, who's the beneficiary of this? And if you look at IPO, banks and, you know, institutional holders and so they hype up a company or stock, new stock as much as possible, you know, to be able to sell it at the price should be as high as possible for them, because they are the ones who are selling you something. So that's one of the reasons that and another important one is that I want to see some quarterly results. But when I saw the S1 of Upstart, I was quite interested in it, and I put it on my personal watch list. The reason that I was interested is I thought, you know, it makes sense to see a business that tackles a problem with AI. And, you know, a FICO score, I mean, first and for all, as far as I know, is only, you know, broadly used in the US. In Europe, I live in Europe, as you know, I don't have a FICO score. Of course, banks do have their own systems, which are very, you know, untransparent. But there is no FICO score. So that's one thing. Or not in the same way, you know, as in the US, where you can easily know your FICO score. And then the second thing is it's very deterministic, that FICO score. What I mean is that, you know, you get put a number on you, and it can, you know, can be something of the past. You know, maybe you have problems paying your student loan for one reason or the other. And I mean, what does that mean 5 years later, 10 years later? Maybe not that much. I mean, you probably have changed a lot, especially from that age. So I think it's a problem, you know, for people who are consumers in that way. But it's, you know, every problem is an opportunity. And I thought, you know, it would make sense to tackle that problem with AI. And of course, AI is you know, it's a buzzword. And, you know, with those kind of hypes, you have two dangers. And the one danger is that, you know, it's already in what I said, people get hyped up. Oh, yeah, AI. The other danger is, you know, the complete opposite. Oh, it's AI, you know, let's throw it away. You always have to see the gray between the black and the white. And I thought in this case, it made sense. And you can call it AI, you can call it big data, you can call it whatever you want, but it makes sense to try to make this better with, you know, data. And that's why I was interested. And then, you know, I was very impressed by the founders as well, especially, you know, Dave Gerard and Paul Gu. You have Anna Councilman as well, but I mean, she came from Google. So it's not that she is not impressive, but especially Gerard and Gu are, you know, the guys to watch here. It was a combination of those things that, you know, really made me look at it. And then, you know, when those first results came out and they blew the expectations out of the water completely, twice in a row, you know, I really researched it much deeper, and you know, then I read the S1 completely, and all the rest, and this two interviews and etc. So that's a bit my story with Upstart.
And for any of the listeners that don't know what Upstart does, can you just explain the business model broadly?
Yeah, well, Upstart is actually a loan originator. It gets revenue. Its revenue comes from banks who pay a fee to get that loan. That's, you know, that's probably the easiest way that I can explain. And one of the things, initially my first reaction was, well, I'm not interested. That was my initial reaction. And but because of those great results, I really looked deeper. And I started thinking, because of that link with Google, both from Dave Gerard and a councilman, I started thinking, well, isn't this much a business like Google in a way that, in a way, Upstart is a form of marketing, actually. So Upstart doesn't have loans. Well, it has about 2% or 3% loans on its own balance sheet, but only for experimentational reasons. So they first test their AI on capital that they have on their in their books to show the results to the bank. So they, a bank is a very conservative institution and they want to see results first before they want to try it out. That's the reason why Upstart takes a little bit of credit risk, but 2 or 3%, and that's for experimental reasons only. But for the rest, actually, you can see Upstart as a connector between people who want a loan and banks or credit unions who want to, give a loan. And using AI there to make the best combination of the two really makes sense to me. So I think that's in part. And then, of course, the bank who gets the loan gets, gives a part of that. It gives a fee, and it depends on the bank, I think, but just a very small part of that loan is given back to Upstart as well. It depends really, but it can be 0%, it can be 0.1, it can be 1% or 2%. I think that's the highest. But it's actually Upstart, you could say, is actually an algorithm, like Google was an algorithm to connect two markets. That's for me, the reason I see that connection with Google. And if you look at what was the advantage that Google had, it was, I don't remember exactly, but a few milliseconds faster than other search engines, right? And it has, better insights. And that's actually what Upstart has as well. So it's not faster, but it has a higher quality of loans compared to its competitors. So that's more or less the business model of Upstart. So it connects people who look for a loan, and people who, or banks, institutions, credit unions, who grant loans. And they try to do that in the best possible way for both. So that means that, if you are a bank, if you use Upstart, that you have either more people who you can give, a loan to, you have the same, number of people, but with, much less defaults. And if you know that, you'd probably know that, if I would take a loan, or you take a loan, we'll probably pay it back, right? But we will have to pay some extra, not for our own credit risk, but for that of others. So actually, the people who pay their loans actually have to pay extra to make up for the losses. And that's how banks and credit unions make a profit on loans as well. And if you can reduce the number of defaults, you can also reduce the APR, so the percentage that you have to pay each year. So
Right. That makes total sense. And the big advantage that everyone talks about is Upstart's AI-driven underwriting model, the data-driven underwriting model. They talk about the big spreadsheet. I think they joke about that in their conference calls and stuff like that. Let's start things off with kind of a big question that people think about here. How hard do you think it would be for someone to compete with their model and replicate it?
Well, it's always, you know, with AI, you're people, I hear a lot of people say, oh, you're essentially, you know, getting a black box, or you have to believe it, or, and that's to a certain extent, that's true. On the other hand, you can, you know, look at secondary parameters to see if the results are good, which they clearly are for Upstart. And I think artificial intelligence, AI, is just starting out. I think we'll see a lot, you know, much more companies using it. And the problem is you cannot see how the mechanics work. If you Google, you see, oh, this is fast, and, you know. But on the other hand, there's a big part of Google that you don't see as well. I think that's the same thing with Upstart. So it's, you know, it's, I don't use the platform of the Trade Desk, for example. I don't use the platform of CrowdStrike, for example, but, you know, they are, I hear people using them saying they're good. I have to believe that. I especially look at their results, and the results of the Trade Desk and of CrowdStrike are extremely good, much better than, you know, their competitors, especially of the same size. And that's how I look at Upstart as well. So I see that. Now, coming back on, is it difficult to make that AI? I think it is. Because Paul Gu is a great programmer. He has developed. Does that mean, you know, that he's a saint and that's the reason why, you know, you should buy a Upstart for your portfolio? No. I mean, there are lots of great developers who are not, you know, invest worthy because they don't have enough, sense of business. Now, the CFPB. So, what was it again? The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Oh. Yeah, that's it. That's a government institution. They issued a letter saying in 2017, this AI is good enough. And what I mean is, we're not going after this one to sue it or whatever. Upstart is the only one who has that letter. And the reason is that they have worked with the CFPB to make sure that there is no bias for any, you know, let's call it taboo, right? So it doesn't discriminate on gender, on race, on the area that you live in, whatever. So this is very important to understand, because it's not easy to get that letter. Now, if it would be just that letter, okay, that would already be a hurdle. But there's a second hurdle. I mean, to get that letter is a big hurdle. But one of the things that Upstart had to do was they had to update the CFPB on a regular basis. That is how it was in the letter. And that means that Paul Gu or someone on his team has been sitting together with the committee every week every week to evaluate. And each week they get critical questions. You know, if you're Paul Gu and you are a good programmer and you get constant feedback like that every single week, I mean, you will improve your algorithm, AI, or whatever you want to call it. It's great feedback. So if people say that Upstart has a data advantage, for me, it's not just, we have this much data of customers. It's much more that, you know, it has been criticized every week. There are no biases in that AI. And, you know, in the meantime, we have seen that it works. And Upstart has done a test, and it's if you take on the same credit risk as what you would do now, there's 75% less chance for a default, right? 75%, which is impressive, of course. Now, could banks come up with such an AI? Suppose one of the big, we're talking about the big banks then, right? I mean, nobody thinks, I think, that, you know, a smaller credit union in a local community, you know, will do that, right? So we're talking about, you know, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, what have you. Suppose that they could do it. Suppose that they, you know, pass that first hurdle and that they, you know, get the same letter. They will still have to, those 4 years, more than 4 years of, you know, constant questions, you know, they still would have to do that. But okay, it's JP Morgan or whatever, whoever, they could do it much faster, let's say a year or so. So now you have Upstart, which has an AI model that works with it, and JPM that has the same, more or less, right? So this is hypothetical. This is maybe 2 years, 3 years out. Now, what will the rest of the big banks do? They will try to come up with their own AI model, of course. Now, will there be another one succeeding? I have my doubts. I mean, yes, they will come up with AI. Will they take those two hurdles as well? I'm not so sure. And at the moment that one of the big banks, let's take JPM. At the moment that they have that AI, the other big banks will have to follow. They will have to follow. And, you know, they can come up with their own AI, which may or may not be as great, right? Or they could even partner with Upstart or take their API, because they can also integrate the software of Upstart in their bank like an API. So that's a part of a code that you just, you know, use on your side, and then it's all branded like it's your own. But, you know, Upstart would get, or it already has that API, by the way. So it would get, a certain part of the revenue. You know, the Twilio model is the same thing there. So, I mean, I think, and also, of course, no big bank, you know, will go to JP Morgan Chase in the hypothetical example and say, oh, well, I like you. You are my friend. I want to take your model as well. Of course not. So I think that people underestimate how difficult it is if you see the full context. And if you see if there would be one big bank having their own AI, it could even be an advantage for Upstart, because other banks, you know, will have to have their own AI, which is as good as their, you know, big competitor, or they will have to come up with something else. So, I mean, it's not something that I'm particularly worried about because of the hurdles, because of, you know, the time that it takes, you know, to get it to that same level of quality. And yeah, I'm certainly aware that big banks have lots of data, but they don't have the structured data that is that are used in AI, because you know random data doesn't mean anything. You really have to structure those data. Even if they can do that, I mean, there's still lots more to the picture. So I have heard this, you know, I have heard his arguments so many times before, but I think people underestimate how difficult it is if you put it into a context.
Right. And that's some great perspective on the competition. And the other big question people have all the time is the quality of loans being originated. People get worried about a financial connected institution or a lender, or in Upstart's case, they're not a lender, but they're you know, enabling lending. You know, how do we track the quality of loans being originated?
Mm-hmm. one of the things that I have seen some people coming out with, the credit score, the FICO score of some of those loans are very low. Well, that's exactly the point, right? If you look at their business model, you can either choose each individual bank, each customer, let's call it, can choose between two assets that Upstart has. So, as I said, if you take a certain credit score, let's say 600, right? If you are a bank and you say, oh, I only want a FICO score of 600 and above, and you do that through Upstart, your default rate will go down by 75%. I mean, we cannot completely control that, but I mean, even if it's 50%, the banks can, you know, get the insights, you know, more easily, because it used to take months, 6 months or longer before, a bank, they tested it first for 6 months. And now one of the things that Dave Jarrett said on the last earnings call was that, you know, they have had, they onboarded a bank now in 50 days. And in those 50 days, the bank was already convinced that, you know, this works. It used to take months and months and months. So the banks will, you know, of course, control if it's true what Upstart claims. And if you read the statements, of course, these are promotional statements in you know, PR and what have you. But even there, you can sense that it's more than just PR talk, and there is real enthusiasm in the statements of, you know, people from banks and credit unions. So that's one side. You can lower your default rate by 75%. The other possibility is that you say, well, let's take the same default risk as we have now, right? What you can do is you can lower the credit worthiness of your potential customers by a lot than at that moment. So a big group which was not which was a target because they were too risky, now suddenly can become customers. So, and those are the two pools that you can work with as a bank. And most banks, you know, choose somewhere between the two, and they can adapt that at any moment. So, it's not just lower. You know, they don't take one pool and then stay there. No, they can really turn the buttons there and look what they see in their results and see what they can come up with that works best for them. And, you know, one of the things that we have seen now is that several banks, four already now, have completely, done away with the FICO score as one of the parameters. So they don't look at a FICO score anymore. They want to look at, you know, the potential of a customer, and not at his or her past. And that's actually, you know, how you have to think about the quality of, you know, of the loans. There will be a mix. There will be a mix of lower defaults for banks, or a lot, you know, the same default on average, of course, and but a lot more, you know, target customers, let's call it. So that's the two sides that you can play with as a bank.
Another question that I think Brad, our friend Brad, most of the listeners probably know him. He's on the show once every 2 weeks. He mentioned to us to ask this question, which is the customer concentration with Credit Karma. So for the first 9 months of this year, 44% of Upstart's loan originations comes from Credit Karma. I'm curious how you think about that. Do you see that as a big risk?
It's definitely one of the risks. I mean, there are a few. Now, just to make sure, so everyone understands. So people go to Credit Karma to check their, you know, their credit score, credit worthiness, what have you, and they are, you know, brought to Upstart's platform. It has gone down. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was more than 50%. So it has come down. Now, I think if you put it in context, that it is still a bit of a risk, but, you know, Credit Karma has been bought by Intuit. And some people are afraid that Intuit would, you know, set up something competing with Upstart. Is that possible? Yes, of course, that's always possible. Nothing is impossible in business, right? But it's, I think, unlikely. One of the reasons that I think it's unlikely is that, you know, Intuit has paid, I think, $8.5 billion to get Credit Karma. If they would do away with Upstart, it's half of the revenue. And it would have to do away with the other, you know, the other customers of Credit Karma as well, because they would be competing as well. So they would actually annihilate Credit Karma completely, their $8.5 billion acquisition. That's one of the reasons that I think it's unlikely that Intuit will start something like that. If it would do it, it would probably remain, you know, as diversified as possible. But I don't see them going into this anytime soon because of, you know, the acquisition. And I think that Intuit could come up with loans, but I'm not sure if they would come up with, I think they would probably focus on business loans and not so much on, you know, personal loans, etc. But, you know, it's, the future is always a surprise to everyone. And it's one of the things that you, it's one of the things that I look at if the quarterly report is filed, you know, in a sec, and I will check it out. And that's one of the things that I will control F to see if, you know, how Credit Karma has done. Or how, you know, how the traffic from Credit Karma has become, you know, less in this case. But it's not something that I, you know, I lie awake at night thinking about Credit Karma. It's, yeah, I mean, ideally, you don't want to see that much of an influence coming from another company. But at the same time, it's not a direct competitor. I don't see Intuit going into direct competition anytime soon or so. There are no signs of that, and would be very strange because it would kill their $8.5 billion acquisition. So, yeah, it's something to, you know, to watch, but not overly concerned.
Yeah, Control F, that's the most important tool for those quarterly reports. They can save you so much time. If you don't use the Control F, you're missing out.
All right, we've got plenty more questions, but we're going to hit a quick ad break before we get to them. Okay, welcome back in. I wanted to know what your thoughts on management are. This you talked about it briefly, but there's Paul Gu, Dave Girard. I think there's three founders, if I'm not mistaken. So what do you think about them? How important are they to your investment?
Yeah, well, the third one is Anna Councilman. She comes from Google as well. Well, they are actually very important. It's one of the things that if it wouldn't have been there, it's not a who gets really excited about credit worthiness. I mean, not me, and you know, not that many people, I think. But when I saw that Dave Girard came from Google and a councilman as well, and when, especially, you know, Girard, he was the one who started, or I'm not sure if he restarted, but he was there from the very beginning with, you know, how is it called now? Google Apps, you know, the G Suite or whatever you want to call it. So the business side of Google, so with Drive and all the docs and what have you, the subscription service. And he has built that from, you know, the ground up to the $1 billion business that it was already several years ago, before he said, you know, I want to do something for myself, and I want to, you know, I want to start my own business, and I want to solve a problem. And you know, he thought really long about the most annoying problem that he could think of, and you know, credit was definitely an annoying problem for him. And initially he, you know, he is a bit, how would I put it? You know, he's not someone who stands out in a crowd. You know, how you have very charismatic leaders, you know, they fill the room from the moment that they, you know, they are there. Dave Girard is, you know, humble. I mean, I'm not sure if that is the correct word, because if you listen to what he says, I mean, he says now, I'm sorry, when they had their IPO, worked with 10 banks. So, and then they, you know, I think they have 31 now. So in a year, they have tripled that. But, you know, he says things like, I cannot imagine not working with hundreds of banks in a few years. You know, I want to take this globally. So if you listen to what he says, you know, he's very ambitious. At the same time, if you, he's, you know, he looks a bit like, you know, that professor that you once had, and then you thought, well, he was a, you know, a gentle guy and, you know, soft spoken, and so he has that side as well, and then the combination with Paul Gu is you know, is great, because. And a councilman, I'll talk about her. You know, she's one of the first that is still underestimated, I think, in Upstart. But Paul Gu is he's brilliant. I mean, he's a Peter Thiel 20 under 20 fellow. So you know, he got into that program. He has a degree in economics and programming, I think it is, or from Yale. You know, he worked at D. Shaw. So D. Shaw is the same quant company, so that Jeff Bezos worked for before he started Amazon. You know, that's a collection of brilliant minds as well. So Paul Gu is that, you know, that guy that you think, oh my, this is prodigal son, and this is, you know, he is the smartest guy in the room, you can be sure. Now, if you talk about Dave Girard and Paul Gu, I think without Anna Councilman, they wouldn't have had the same success, because starting a company is more than just solving technical problems. It's also working with people, and that's, you know, she has been doing the HR department, and I think that's very important. And she has been one of the driving forces behind, you know, Upstart going fully digital, telework then. I think at this moment, 75% of the people working for Upstart, you know, have never worked at the head office because, you know, the headquarters, because they, you know, they only started after the pandemic started. And that's, you know, very important to understand, because in that way, Upstart can really get the best talent from everywhere. Because if you are, you know, 6,753rd Silicon Valley company that wants that same AI talent, well, good luck if you're smaller, right? So I think that's very important to understand as well. And I have a few subscribers who are you know, AI specialists, and they say, and that's, you know, I cannot you know, judge on that myself, but I believe them. I say that they say that you know, Upstart really has top talent, because you have AI and you have AI, right? Because a lot of people call an algorithm AI because it sounds better nowadays. And you know, there's a big difference between an algorithm that can learn on its own, because that's artificial intelligence, right? And one that, you know, just performs, you know, a regular job and, you know, automates a few things. And they say that Upstart really has, you know, top talent. They say that one of my subscribers says, of the 100 people that work in AI, one is really a great AI developer. Is that true or not? He says that the rest are just people, or not everybody. You have skills, of course, but a lot of people working in AI don't have the specific training to create something completely new. You can discuss about that. I'm not 100% sure that is correct, but it's something I think of. And with you know, Paul Gu, and I have named Dave Gerard now. I have named Paul Gu. I have named Anna Councilman. But those are also the three co-founders. And, you know, that may sound, you know, very normal, but it's quite exceptional that three co-founders are still together after, I think, 12 years now or so. And I think that is because of the fact that they are completely different. You know, Dave Gerard had a lot of experience, and he found out the first time he met Paul Gu, he found out that the parents of Paul Gu were actually younger than he is. And then, you know, so Paul Gu is still very young. I think he's, I don't know, 30 now? Is he already 30? I'm not sure. And then you have a councilman who really has that, you know, talent for, let's call it, human connections. And that is often so underrated. So the three co-founders are, you know, definitely part of my investment thesis.
Right. And a lot of people talk about credit risk when it comes to Upstart, and they have a few of the loans on the balance sheet, like you mentioned, but how comfortable do you think, as they scale, will they be for taking any of this stuff in-house? Have they talked about taking stuff in-house, or do you think they're all going to make it more third-party loans?
I cannot see them doing it anytime soon. So I don't think they will take credit, more and more credit risk on their balance sheet, because, you know, they really position themselves as a tech company, and not a, you know, semi bank, let's call it. I think they, you never know down the road, maybe, you know, 7, 8, 10 years out, maybe they hit a speed bump and they look into it deeper. But I cannot see it coming anytime soon, because you know, they still have so much, you know, potential market to gain, market share to gain, that, you know, for me, it would be a red flag right now. So I wouldn't, again, unless it's, you know, it's a bit more because of a certain reason, what have you, there are always nuances. But if they would say, you know, we're becoming, you know, a big lender ourselves, I would not be, I think it would be re-rated very fast in their, in its multiple as well, because right now they are the tech company. At that moment, they're becoming another, you know, another lender. And I think, you know, their valuation probably would go down, I don't know, by 75% or so. So.
Right. And let's get more into some of the segments of their business. They just had the Prodigy acquisition in the spring. That seems to be going great so far. Can you explain what that company is and what opportunity it presents when combined with Upstart?
Yeah. So they originate loans as well, but then car loans. So they are, you know, they are focused on car loans, and they start actually with the place where people buy cars, so car dealerships. So they are actually what Upstart is for banks. They are for car dealerships, and they, you know, they try to, you know, if you buy a car, you don't want to pay too much attention to credit, right? To credit, I mean, you just want an easy solution when you buy a car. And so, you know, most loans are originated in the car dealerships. Now, again, you have the same mechanism that works in car loans than you have in personal loans. So people defaulting means that other people have to pay extra credit risk to get, you know, to get some profitability for, you know, the banks or credit unions or what have you. Now, what this means is, Prodigy could even and is already new that refinance car loans at a cheaper price and undercuts everyone on price on APRs, and is already doing that. Now, I think it's very early at this moment. What I mean, so they have originated, I think, $2 billion. Prodigy has originated $2 billion in car loans. It's very early in that sense that, you know, they're just starting out. I think some people already expect, you know, results in next quarter or so. I think it will take time. At this moment, personal loans will remain the main business of Upstart, but I really like it that, you know, it's diversifying its stream of revenue, because I always have loved companies. C Limited, for example, if you look at C, you have a more mature company in, you know, Garena, their gaming division, then you have Shopee, which is already big but still growing immensely fast. And then you have more or less like a startup in C Money. So those are three divisions. And I really like that part, that companies almost have startups in their own companies. And you have seen that with Google as well. You have seen that in Amazon. You have seen that in Apple. And those are really important signs for me that, you know, this company thinks over the long term. This is not something for, you know, next year. This is something for, you know, the next decade. And then they will probably go into the mortgage market as well. And then you have another, you know, growth pillar for years to come. So that's how I look at it. This is their internal startup that they have acquired because they already have some car loans, et cetera. But it's still small, and I think that Prodigy acquisition will pay off immensely over time if, you know, if they play it well.
You mentioned mortgages. Have they made any moves yet into that business? And then how important do you think that business can be long term?
Well, they have officially announced it on the last earnings call that they will go into mortgage. So they will work on it in 2022. So what work on it means is not that clear. I don't expect them. Maybe they could launch something, but you know, again, very early stage, more to test the waters, to see how their AI performs in that market, et cetera, et cetera. It's something which will, you know, take time to work out, but it's a huge market. I mean, if you look at mortgage in total in the US, it's 11 trillion. I mean, that's, I don't know, but I cannot even think of how big that is. You know, it's so huge. And you know what they say? If we can take 1% of that market, I'm joking, but Upstart doesn't say that. But, you know, it's a huge opportunity. And I think that there as well, if they can you know, break that code of bringing down the defaults a lot, or Dave Jarrett talked on the conference call about the missing million, and he said if you look at 2001, so way before the financial crisis, which you know came because of a housing bubble, as we know, but 2001 there was no bubble yet, and if you look at 2015, you see that there are 1 million fewer. People who have a mortgage. And that is because of, you know, the fact that it has become much harder to get a mortgage, even, you know, not just because of the, you know, as coming back to earth after the, you know, the housing bubble, but, you know, it's there are still, there's still a big gap, if you compare to before the bubble started forming. So he says this is a great potential market. And if they can do the same thing there for those people. And I think, I mean, you know, you can be very cynical about Upstart saying, you know, it's credit and they're, you know, they're just interested in money. But I believe Jared also, because he talks, you know, the, Upstart is part of a charities, you know, to give more people, you know, access to credit because it can change their lives, right? I mean, buying a house is, you know, so important for so many people, and you can be, you know, can be cynical about that, but I mean, you really change the life of people who cannot afford a house right now because they're not granted a loan. And if Upstart wants to, the people who deserve the loan, despite, you know, certain things that have happened in the past, it's not about the past, it's about the future. And they want to, you know, to energize that potential in the market of, you know, addressing those people and giving them a mortgage loan as well, and I think and it's interesting to see that, you know, if you look at, you know, the terms or the periods, it's getting longer and longer, right? And first you have personal loans now, which are, you know, short term, then you have car loans, which are already, you know, let's call it medium term, and then you have mortgage, which are long term, 25 years, 30 years or so, and that will also over time stabilize, you know, the predictability of the revenue of Upstart. So yeah, I think if Upstart can do the same thing, connect people who want access to the market or to mortgage and cannot get one, and you know, the institutions who want, you know, who want to lend out money but who are afraid of defaults, if they can be that efficient, connected between those two markets with both, or, you know, two parties with both their own, you know, desire and make, make that a, you know, a great match for both parties. I think they can do extremely well over time. But again, it's very, very early. And I think people underestimate sometimes how early Upstart still is. It's almost a startup. I had to say it. I think it's extremely early, and that's also something typical. You know, the concentration on Credit Karma, you see that in early companies. I think it's you will see with those new markets, you will see that Upstart will change dramatically as a company itself as well. I think okay. So it will become mature.
Right. And let's do kind of a backwards question into a valuation discussion. Upstart in some ways is trying to dethrone FICO, which, you know, if anyone doesn't know, that's credit scores. But they already have approximately twice its market cap. How do you think Upstart can fulfill these high expectations over the next decade? And do you think that comparison has merits?
No. Why not? Because it's all about revenue, of course. And if you look at the revenue of FICO, it's not because it's so much older. I think if you look at 2022, so next year, I think the revenue of Upstart is estimated to be 10-15% lower than that of FICO. I mean, that's not such a huge gap. And of course, last quarterly results for FICO, the revenue was down 10%. You know, if it was up in the quarters before, it was single digits. I mean, of course, Upstart is expected to grow faster. And it's normal that a company that grows faster, gets a higher multiple as well. And also, you cannot really compare the two. I mean, it's a bit like saying, Google at the time, right? Google wanted to replace Yahoo. So does it make sense that it already has a bigger market cap than Yahoo? Well, yes, because there are so much more potential. If Upstart really break the new markets that it goes into and be successful there as well, I think it could still 10x and maybe more. I think there's a lot of confusion about the actual model, but I think that Upstart is some sort of toll booth MasterCard Visa type of company, or it has that potential. It is not that company yet. Let's make it clear. But it could become that type of company that, if you want, as if you have loans and you want to go into that market and you do not have it, you have a disadvantage. I mean, and in that way, you know, it's the same thing. The take rate will be very low. I mean, for Visa, MasterCard, it's, you know, what is it, 2% or so. And I think it will be the same thing for Upstart. But if they can continue to add new partners, to add new markets, I mean, the potential is huge. Of course, there's always execution risk. The company has to do everything perfectly, you know, general picture has to be perfectly. There can always be mistakes. Every company makes mistakes. That's normal. But the execution should be very will be very important. And I think if you look at what Dave Gerrard has already done there, if you look at his past at Google and Google Apps and G Suite and what have you, I think that is an extra sign that this guy knows how to execute, and that is also something that gives me confidence. Of course, it's no guarantee. there are lots of examples of very smart people who have proven themselves in the past who still screw up. But nothing is certain in investing. Of course, you look for a probability and you look for factors that can improve that probability in your advantage, right?
Right. And I mean, if you're betting on a guy that built Google Drive, I mean, that's, you know, one of the best products out there. But sorry, Ryan, do we have one more last question?
Yeah, last question. I guess, how could this investment go wrong? What are sort of the biggest risks associated with it?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest risks that are named now are, you know, the traffic from a Credit Karma and, you know, the fact that a lot of the loans are sold to just, you know, two banks and mostly Cross River Bank, which is a bank which I think is really visionary. I have been saying for years, and this is not my original idea. I got it from Unscaled by Heman Tanisha, which was a quintessential book for my investing. In that book, Heman Tanisha says that he sees the future of finances as a completely different from what you know, and he compares it to telecommunications. So, you know, you had the big players, you know, the hardware and the lines, and then you have the internet, right? And if you look at the internet, you know, boom in 2000, a company like, you know, Intel, for example, or AT&T had huge valuations, but could never, you know, really return to those kind of valuations, right? Because if you look at the history of the internet, you see that probably the best time to start investing in the internet was 2010. Okay, that had a bit to do with the crash as well. But even if you started 2012, 2014, 2016, and you saw what was happening, the real value was in the products built on top of that infrastructure. If you make that comparison with banks, banks will become the infrastructure and not the ones who take the huge profits anymore. They will have reliable revenue. Why? Because if you see one thing that has continued is that there's more and more regulation for banks. So they will become more and more regulated, and the real value will be built on top of their infrastructure, namely fintech. And Upstart is one, Square is one. You know the names. There are plenty out there, and you know some will be huge, and others will, you know, go away, probably in a few years. But there will be huge winners there. And I think the biggest risk is not the fact that for Upstart at this moment they have, you know, revenue concentration traffic concentration. The biggest risk is that another, startup would come and completely have a better model, work better with the banks. I don't know. So you never know. Maybe that company is already out there. So if we talk about AI, sometimes it's, you know, a small difference can make a huge difference in the end. And I think that is the biggest risk to Upstart, that it would be disrupted. As simple as that.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions we have. I guess for any listeners that haven't heard you before, where can they find you?
Well, they can find me on Seeking Alpha. I publish free articles there. So if you go to From Growth to Value, on Seeking Alpha, you can read my free articles. If you are more interested, you can go to my marketplace, Potential Multibaggers, which has, of course, more content and portfolios and chat and what have you. You can always find me on Twitter if you're listening in car right now. Maybe that message is a bit too, then you just have to remind @FromValue and you go to my pinned tweet and you'll see everything as well.
Right. And we'll make sure to link that in the show notes. And we can attest to it. The write-ups on potential multi-baggers are very thorough and they're great analysis. So
thank you.
All awesome. Right. Yeah. Thanks for joining today, Chris.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. That's going to do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. Remember, we are not financial advisors. Anything we say on the show is not formal advice or recommendation. Ryan and I are general partners at Arch Capital. Arch Capital clients may hold securities discussed in this podcast. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.